This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 6, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Congressional leaders announced John Roberts' confirmation hearing to become the next Chief Justice on the Supreme Court. As Philippines President Arroyo faces voter fraud charges, we'll hear about the military's crackdown on political activists. And as the relief efforts continue for hurricane victims, we'll hear from Baton Rouge and New Orleans. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Typhoon Nabi came ashore in southern Japan and South Korea today, killing five people, injuring dozens, and forcing tens of thousands to flee their homes. Waves, driven by 78-mile-per-hour winds, slammed into coastal barriers, and storm surges flooded seaside towns. The eye of the storm made landfall at Isahaya near Nagasaki on the mountainous island of Kyushu. Kyushu is home to about 10% of Japan's nearly 130 million people. The typhoon grounded hundreds of flights in Japan and South Korea, blocked trains and ferry services, and closed down highways. Tens of thousands of travelers were stranded. The typhoon, named Nabi, meaning butterfly in Korean, was classified as a Category 3 storm. Forecasters expect it to weaken to a Category 1 over the next 24 hours. Japan sent troops to fortify barriers, assist evacuees, and provide other help in storm-hit areas. More than 270,000 households in Kyushu lost power. Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi cut short a two-day campaign trip to western Japan. And in Mexico, heavy rains coupled with deforestation has resulted in landslides that have killed five children and destroyed nine schools in the last 2 days. India says it will cut troop levels in Indian-administered Kashmir if there's an end to violence. From Delhi, Vinod K. Jose reports.
The pro-Indian faction of the Kashmiri Nationalist Front, the Hurriyat Conference, met with Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh in the first-ever talks between a Kashmiri nationalist group and an Indian Prime Minister. Singh promised to reduce the number of Indian troops in Kashmir if insurgent violence from the other half of Kashmir under Pakistani occupation stops. An estimated 500,000 Indian soldiers are deployed in Kashmir to combat the self-determination struggle. The Indian Prime Minister also assured that all arrests made under the Anti-Terrorism Act, POTA, and the Public Safety Act will be reviewed. While Indian media was celebrating the talk as a major breakthrough, the Kashmiris are not quite as happy with the talks. They say only promises have come out and not any action. In fact, today, Kashmiri police charged a woman nationalist leader and a dozen of her followers under a tough public safety law, drawing strong condemnation from the general public. Other Kashmiri nationalist leaders disapprove of the talks as they believe the current delegation does not represent the ongoing freedom struggle in Kashmir and is pro-India. From New Delhi, I'm Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
The Committee 68 for Democratic Freedom filed a formal complaint today with the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights, calling for the reinvestigation of the 1971 Corpus Christi massacre. Chad Benjamin Potter reports from Washington, D.C.
During the Catholic feast of Corpus Christi on June 10, 1971, an Army-trained hit squad called the Falcons descended upon thousands of students and textile workers protesting for democratic solidarity in the Avenida San Cosme. These hitmen murdered at least 25 students, sending the progressive leaders underground to avoid imprisonment and torture. Now, some 35 years later, the survivors of this atrocity have reemerged and are demanding justice. Alejandro Alvarez, one such survivor and member of Committee 68 for Democratic Freedom, says this issue must be considered by the international community.
The Mexican government is a signatory of international treaties, and there is a room to make a complaint in an international commission.
This complaint, which singles out Luis Echeverria, the president of Mexico during the massacre, Mario Moya Palencia, his secretary of state, and numerous other army generals, will hopefully be picked up by the Inter-American Court in Costa Rica. For Free Speech Radio in Washington, D.C., this is Chad Benjamin Potter.
At least seven civilians were killed today during an operation by Iraqi and U.S. troops. One U.S. soldier died when a bomb struck his vehicle yesterday. Iraqi police and troops backed by U.S. forces launched the operation some days ago in Tal Afar, which they claim is a conduit for foreign fighters slipping into the country. Iraqi forces have now begun compulsory evacuation of the town's central Saray district. And in Baghdad, a parliamentary panel drafting a new constitution says last-minute efforts to fine-tune the text to overcome objections from minority Sunni Arabs failed. 5 million copies of the new document will go into print starting on Thursday in time for a referendum due by October 15th. Many Sunni leaders have vowed to make sure the draft is rejected in its present form at the referendum. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
President Bush and Congress pledged separate investigations into the federal response to Hurricane Katrina. Many congressional members spent their first day in session calling for oversight into the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, as well as restructuring the way the U.S. responds to emergencies. In D.C., Selena Musuta reports on the future of investigations and proposed Hurricane Katrina relief plans.
With Democratic Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine announced that there will be investigations on the state and federal response to Hurricane Katrina. Collins is the chairperson of the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, which is the Senate's chief oversight committee.
We would be remiss as the chairman and ranking member of the Homeland Security Committee if we did not ask the hard questions needed to understand what went so wrong and what our country must do to improve our ability to respond to future crises.
Public hearings on FEMA and other federal and state response agencies could happen as soon as next week. Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts and Republican Senator Michael Enzi of Wyoming met with Hurricane Katrina relief organizations to receive recommendations on how to address health care, education, economic, and structural devastation. Ted Kennedy.
There are 80,000 children that were going to school in New Orleans that are not going to school today. Those children are scattered. Some have moved to different jurisdictions. Teachers have moved in different areas. Those records are absolutely destroyed. We're facing a healthcare crisis in that region as well.
Mildred Brown is the legislative representative of ACORN, one of the largest community organizations of low and moderate income families whose national headquarters is in New Orleans. Many of ACORN's members live in the Louisiana and Mississippi area. Brown came to the meeting held by Kennedy.
We're concerned about health problems, education. We want to make sure our schools are up and running as soon as possible. And we're also concerned about jobs. We want to make sure that many of the jobs that will be open for those who are coming in to do the reconstruction, that many of those jobs go to some of our members, people of low and moderate income.
The Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee will convene on Thursday to discuss the proposals outlined by Kennedy and Enzi. Selena Masuta, FSRN, in Washington, D.C.
As Army and National Guard units continue to arrive in New Orleans, rescue efforts are winding down, but cleanup efforts have yet to begin. Most of the city remains without electricity, water, or gas, but many residents have elected to stay, especially in parts of the city that do have some services. David Enders files this report from New Orleans.
Dave Williams is part of a search and rescue crew that came from San Diego earlier in the week. Anecdotally, Williams says, he's seen about 15 or 20 bodies in different areas of the city, either in the water or in homes. But in the area Williams and his team were searching on Monday, near the Chef Montour Highway on the city's easternmost side, not everyone wanted to be rescued.
There are some in this area of town that feel they're comfortable enough, and this is where they've lived for most or all of their life, and they're willing to stick it out. Well, we're at this point in the operation, we're checking each house, marking each house for contact, hazards, whatever we find. And if we find someone that's willing to stay or wants to stay, then we're letting them know that today will be our last time through this area as far as search and rescue. And they need to be prepared for the long haul.
As U.S. military helicopters continued to ferry people from downtown New Orleans to the airport, some residents said they had elected to stay because they didn't have the money to leave or because they didn't want to leave their pets. Others said they had heard rumors about the conditions at the Superdome in the New Orleans Convention Center, where residents were initially sent to wait for evacuation. Others simply didn't want to be sent to parts unknown with nothing more than a single bag of their belongings. As he pushed a shopping cart full of supplies through the French Quarter, Gregory Tavia, whose house was flooded, said he had spent 3 days at the convention center before deciding to return to his girlfriend's house.
For a couple of days, it was deplorable. It was deplorable conditions. It was smelling like feces and urine.
Though virtually all of the city's businesses remain closed, a couple of bars have reopened on Bourbon Street in the French Quarter. In the Faubourg-Marigny neighborhood, between the French Quarter and the Ninth Ward, where the flooding begins, people sat outside Cajun's Pub, drinking beers and barbecuing. Neighborhoods across the street were still flooded, and virtually every business on the street had been looted except for the pub. Joanne Guido, the owner, said the bar had been open since the hurricane hit and sustained minor damage during the storm.
One of the levees gave way, and then we got about a foot of water in the bar. And then about 2 days after that, the water finally subsided and went down. Then the looting started. Now that was really scary. You had gangs with vans, trucks, just driving up and down, going into every damn business, prying it open, getting in there, getting into the ATM machines, getting into the cigarettes or tobacco. Then after they left, then the regular, like for an example, the grocery store or Walgreens, then the regular people came in and went in and got food, necessities where they could survive off of. And the only reason we weren't broken into is because we were here. But we rode it out all the way. We got food, we're cooking, we have a generator, gas. You know, everybody that comes by loves it because of the fact that you come in and you're getting away from all the disaster in the city. You come in here and it's almost like normality, where you can sit down, watch TV, see what's going on, have a cold beer, you know, and the food, people are bringing food to us that hasn't spoiled yet, and we're cooking it and giving it to everybody. We're just trying to survive. That's it.
In New Orleans, I'm David Unders reporting for FSRN.
The city of Baton Rouge is accommodating the hundreds of thousands of evacuees from Hurricane Katrina. The city appears to be the first stop for many who are waiting until relatives in other states are able to come and get them. Yet many of the evacuees are planning on staying, at least until they can go back home to New Orleans. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell and Dolores San Bernard report from Baton Rouge.
Residents in Baton Rouge are feeling the effects of a city that has nearly doubled in population in just 1 week.
It's very hard to find food. We have to get it when we can find it. Very hard to get gas. Doesn't matter. We have to accommodate these people.
This woman was buying food and necessities from depleted shelves of a grocery store for family and friends who are staying with her who are from New Orleans. Realizing that they won't go home for several months, many evacuees are beginning to think about a job, permanent housing, and schools for the children. Sonia Robinson is from Orleans Parish in New Orleans. She's staying at Mount Pilgrim Baptist Church with her four children. She registered her kids for school this morning.
Education comes first. I don't want them to be behind, so I'm willing to cooperate whatever they helpful, so I'm willing to let them go to school.
Today begins the fourth week of school for Baton Rouge children. They will have a lot of new students in their classrooms. The school board will accept every student. The principal of Scotlandville Magnet High School, who doesn't want her name mentioned, has been registering new students all morning.
We simply take the applications, and I will send those down daily, and they will put it in a database so that all 16 high schools will take equal number of students. However many we have, then that's how many we'll accept, and we'll gladly accept those.
Scotlandville Magnet High School has a limit of 1,200 students. They are already at capacity before accepting any evacuees.
We don't have quite enough teachers, and there is a bit of overcrowding, but again, we're scheduling, we're redoing some schedules, and right now we do have some overcrowding, but that's going to be balanced out.
Classrooms will receive more desks, and lab rooms will be turned into classrooms. The city of Baton Rouge is also accepting applications for teachers from New Orleans, hoping to lighten the teacher deficit that comes with the extra students. most evacuation centers are offering school registration. Because many left New Orleans with few belongings, the city is waiving requirements for transcripts, birth certificates, and proof of vaccinations. They are working with the state of Louisiana Department of Education to get that information for each student. Danny showed up for Scotlandville Magnet High School this morning. He borrowed a uniform shirt from his cousin who goes to that school and bought the uniform khaki pants yesterday. He had a backpack in tow and was with his dad to register and ready to start school today. This is what he had to say about the new start.
It bothers me, but I mean, I'll get over it because my school's underwater, so I really don't have nowhere else to go.
Are you going to miss your friends?
Yeah, but a lot of them are up here in Baton Rouge.
As of this morning, the city of Baton Rouge has enrolled more than 1,500 elementary, middle, and high school students. For Free Speech Radio News in Baton Rouge, I'm Leanne Caldwell with Dolores M. Bernal. We would also like to thank Mount Pilgrim Baptist Church for providing shelter and food for us in Baton Rouge.
Hundreds of people in Washington, D.C. viewed the body of the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist in the Supreme Court building today. Rehnquist died at the age of 80 on Saturday night after serving 33 years on the bench. John Roberts, President Bush's nominee to replace Rehnquist, was one of eight pallbearers who carried the coffin into the Supreme Court's Great Hall. Meanwhile, congressional leaders announced that Roberts' confirmation hearing to become the next Chief Justice has been rescheduled for Monday. Mitch Jezrich brings us this update from Capitol Hill.
People quietly queued up outside the Supreme Court to view the body of Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Also outside the court were numerous television crews and flowers laid out on the building stairs. This morning, as pallbearers, which included his potential successor John Roberts, laid him in the Great Hall of the Supreme Court, where his body will remain until Wednesday afternoon. His funeral, also tomorrow, will be a state-sponsored event that includes a 19-gun salute. With respect to the funeral and the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, both the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter, and the ranking Democrat, Patrick Leahy, announced that John Roberts' confirmation hearings will begin on Monday, September 12th, at high noon Eastern. At a Capitol Hill press conference, Specter spoke well of Roberts.
And I think that Judge Roberts may have a real chance to bring the court together based on the personality which I have seen, if he is confirmed. And I think he may have a little different view about television, something that I have advocated for more than a decade in the court.
The elevation of John Roberts' nomination to Chief Justice will likely embolden his opposition. Last week, numerous groups came out to oppose Roberts, including the National Women's Law Center, the National Leadership Conference for Civil Rights, the National Lesbian and Gay Task Force, and the disability rights group, the ADA Watch. The number two Democrat in the Senate, Richard Durbin of Illinois, says the elevation does change the dynamic of Roberts' confirmation hearing.
Put it in perspective, we're talking about moving from the Rehnquist Court to the Roberts Court for the next generation. I think it raises the importance level of the hearings, makes it even more important for him to be forthcoming with answers and information.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezrich in Washington.
The Philippines Congress today rejected opposition attempts to impeach President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, who's facing voter fraud charges. Rupert Cook reports from Manila.
The impeachment vote followed allegations against President Arroyo of corruption and electoral fraud. She has denied the charges. The opposition has vowed to continue their campaign through the courts and through street demonstrations. Opposition groups gathered in Manila Tuesday for marches in support of the president's impeachment. Former President Cory Aquino, who led the People's Power Movement which toppled Ferdinand Marcos, also joined the protesters. However, the anti-Arroyo demonstrations have, up to now, not managed to match the hundreds of thousands of protesters who were instrumental in ousting Ferdinand Marcos in 1986, as well as Joseph Estrada in 2001. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Manila, the Philippines.
While the international community focuses on voter fraud charges against Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, a lesser-known battle is also being waged against people in that country. Since Arroyo replaced President Joseph Estrada in 2001, the country has been steeped in turmoil. In the 4.5 years since she took office, a reign of terror has gripped the nation as human rights organizers, political activists, church leaders, lawyers, journalists, farmers, and others continue to die at the hands of the military. FSRN's Leilani Albano reports.
Since the notorious General Jovito Palparan was relocated to the area in February, the island has been under siege.
Did you know how he died?
Yes, sir.
How?
He was stabbed by soldiers.
That was Julius Galubid, a resident of Villarreal. On July 16 of this year, Julius watched as his father Constancio was brutally murdered by the military. Legal counsel for the Galubid family addressed their case during a people's tribunal held in late August of this year.
The murder and abduction of Constancio Galubid exemplifies the terror that is now gripping Samar and Leyte because of the indiscriminate, violent character of the counterinsurgency being waged by the government against the people.
Due to continuous political pressure from human rights groups, General Palparan was reassigned to another region in mid-August. However, the killings have not ceased. Most recently, a human rights attorney and a religious leader were attacked in Samar. Bayan Chair attorney Norman Bakar was shot to death on September 1, while Carapatan leader Reverend Raul Domingo remains in a state of coma after he was shot by suspected military soldiers in August 20. The shootings of Galubid, Bakar, and Domingo are not isolated incidents, but part of a massive campaign to suppress political organizing in the area. According to activists, the government's motives are primarily economic. For decades, Samareños have been staunchly opposed to mining in the region. By killing off human rights organizers and others through military assaults, says Gurley Padilla of the Ecumenical Movement for Justice and Peace, U.S. and other foreign investors could more easily move into the area.
The deployment of military personnel in the area also point to the fact that these military personnel does not protect the Filipino people living in the communities, but instead protects the welfare of those implementing government projects and multinational or transnational operations in the area.
Although President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo has stayed silent, she has been hardly neutral on the issue. Organizers draw a direct link between the murders to the beleaguered GMA administration, which is struggling to suppress mounting opposition from the people. Studies show that the government has incurred an unprecedented 4,200 cases of human rights violations with over 232,000 victims during GMA's period in office.
It is ironic that we have a people power installed president who did not respond to the needs of the people, but instead has enforced her fascist hand to the people who are now suffering within that period, 4.5 years of state terror.
For FSRN, this is Leilani Albano.
Egypt's first multi-candidate presidential election will take place tomorrow, although there is little suspense over the winner. Everyone expects President Hosni Mubarak, who has been in power for 24 years, to secure a fifth term. Ursula Lindsay reports from Cairo.
Supporters of presidential hopeful Ayman Nour yell their enthusiasm at a rally in downtown Cairo. The chances that Nour will win are extremely slim. His campaign is small and underfunded, while President Mubarak has the support of his ruling party and the whole state apparatus. Members of the Egyptian government, such as Prime Minister Ahmed Nazif, have touted the election as a step towards democracy.
It is just more proof that the government and the people of Egypt are intent on having a free and fair election to show the world and going ahead with the political reform that it has promised.
But many observers say the election has been set up in such a way as to ensure a Mubarak victory. The new election law introduced by the president only allows the heads of official parties to run. There are 10 candidates running for president. Most are the heads of small, unknown parties. Other than Noor, only Noman Goma, the head of the Waft party, has run anything approaching a real campaign. The banned but tolerated Muslim Brotherhood might have challenged Mubarak, but under the election law, it wasn't allowed to run a candidate. Several leftist parties and opposition groups have boycotted the election altogether. Hassan Nafa is a professor of political science at Cairo University.
It is not a fair election because from the first beginning, you prevented every independent candidate from being a candidate. And the official political parties are not representative of the whole political spectrum in the country.
Because of perceptions such as these, many Egyptians say they won't bother to vote. There are also widespread concerns about election fraud. In previous votes, there have been cases of ballot tampering and voters being intimidated and prevented from entering polling stations. But some view the election, however flawed, as a good thing. Mohammed Imam is volunteering at an NGO that has been monitoring the campaigns and the election itself. In a small room full of busy volunteers, he says he knows Mubarak will win, but he believes the election will usher in change.
We have new people against the president. This is the difference here in our election.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
The Bush administration has yet to respond to offers of aid from Cuba for hurricane relief. President Fidel Castro has pledged 1,100 doctors as well as medicine for residents devastated from the damage and added that politics shouldn't come between a humanitarian gesture from one people to another. FSRN's Joseph Mutu reports from Havana.
Cuba no podría hacer lo más mínimo.
Cuba, said the Cuban leader, might not be able to offer much help to the crew of a spaceship or nuclear submarine in danger, but to the victims of Katrina facing imminent death, the island can offer significant assistance. Last week, the Cuban parliament held a minute of silence for those who died in the hurricane, and the images of human misery being shown on television here have gripped the nation. The island's offer to send 1,100 doctors, along with needed medical supplies, to the worst-hit areas in and around New Orleans has still not been acknowledged by Washington, but is evidence of the close link Cubans feel with the people of the United States, regardless of past or present hostilities. Jorge Alberto, an actor and playwright, summed up the feeling here.
I'm sure that there are millions of Cubans that would go to help in any way, not only the doctors. The fame of the Cuban people, of its solidarity, is not something that has been invented. It's something that exists. It is amazing. In hours, a whole troop of 1,100 doctors was ready. This is not only for the United States. Everyone knows that, that we would have done this for any people in the world. If I could, I would go as a volunteer to help people getting out of this disaster.
The number of doctors ready to leave for Louisiana and Mississippi, said Fidel Castro, was 1,586, with an additional 85 volunteer doctors from other countries who are newly graduated from the island's Latin American School of Medicine, where they were trained for free. All appeared at Havana's convention center carrying olive green backpacks laden with medical supplies, ready to leave at a moment's notice. Nati is a cleaner who has been touched by the suffering of the Gulf Coast hurricane victims.
We are all Americans. The desire to help has nothing to do with the concept of one country or another. It's for everyone, beyond politics, beyond race, beyond religion. It's helping people, and these people need help.
Cubans, who profit from a first-class civil defense system which ensures little loss of life when hurricanes hit the island, are deeply shocked by the images on their television screens and are asking the same questions about what went wrong with the evacuation plan. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joseph Mutti in Havana.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Today, we'd like to welcome back KPFK in Los Angeles as an FSRN station. I'm Aura Bogalo.